This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
We've got about a quarter of an hour, nearly 20 minutes for discussion now. Does anybody want to come straight in at this point? Well, there were one or two issues that came up in there, not least the boundaries between further and higher education that I thought were interesting. I wonder what the three of you think were the sort of message from yesterday's cuts, particularly in the division of the lost places, where we now apparently are going to have sort of 8,000 of the original 10,000 surviving in the full-time degrees, but only 2,000 part-time places, and no particular mention that I saw of foundation degrees. And I wonder, yet we are apparently going to recycle some of the money that's saved within the business department into more FE. Does this, do we think, mean less interest in foundation degrees, or more that the money should be shifting towards FE, as Vince Cable indeed had said he wanted to happen in the run-up to the election? Malcolm, you sort of brought up the boundaries between the two. How do you think that's going to play out?
I think if we look at the underlying rationale for most of the cuts at the moment, it's to get public expenditure back into some kind of order. And clearly further education is cheaper than higher education. Therefore, that alone has to be an important driver towards a greater integration of the two. I thought it was interesting in seeing that this 10,000 student cut, or maybe it was 10,000 extra, depending on where your baseline is, was still divided up so crisply into full-time and part-time. Mm-hmm. And I think anyone from anyone else in the world would have to say, why in the heavens do we do that? Because it itself becomes immediately manipulative and says something about a view of what is proper education or the most important education. While the world from Holloway Road, as I now see it, isn't one where that is the most important issue. The issue is, how do we provide the best access for the students as they need the support? So if one was to be very radical, you'd have to say the idea of course-based funding might in the end start to break down to something more flexible with greater variation, or maybe even modularly based, as a lot of the rest of the world is. That would be a little extrapolation of your very innocent questions.
I mean, I guess part of the reason that they do that is because of the entitlement to student loans, which is the big worry as the numbers go up, isn't it? But also that is the sort of politically sensitive one that is going to be all over the newspapers when UCAS comes out of Purdah eventually and tells us how many people are applying for what. They won't be telling us about the part-timers.
No, but it's very interesting to see that if you do go down that road of greater flexibility, and Hefke's already under notice from the previous government to come up with more flexible funding, you have to end up with more flexible concept of curriculum. And that could mean that the gold standard of the three-year honours degree becomes eventually a minority form of education, particularly in the earlier years. The kind of things you were talking about, Paul, about community colleges. Maybe that more solid, more broadly based one or two years, then leading on to something more specialised, gives a greater chance for students, whether full-time or part-time, to achieve and have greater confidence in their learning.
Could I pick on both of those points, Sean? I mean, I think in terms of the government's announcement yesterday, I personally wouldn't actually read too much into it. It's a one-year announcement for something which needs to happen incredibly quickly. So, yes, it's a change from the previous government's policy, but this is a quick fix which is designed to resolve rather some political things rather than actually be a long-term solution. So that putting on an additional, creating 5,000 additional foundation degree places at quite short notice is actually quite a challenging thing to do given the nature of foundation degrees in the first place. I would suspect, and I have no real knowledge of this, that having Hefke itself having considered the bids that it had received for the various different places may have actually given some guidance to the department as to where those places may be best allocated, i.e. did they actually receive enough bids for the 5,000 places that they were offering in the first place, in which case this could have been a good way of getting out of an embarrassing situation. But I think, I mean, it's a very good point. And I think it's also, given the timing, something which I think Lord Brown himself needs to reflect upon and report back upon. And that picks up very much on Malcolm's point, that actually there is consistent pressure, I think, from all of the messages that have gone back to Lord Brown, that there needs to be a much more flexible system, both in terms of student support, but actually in terms of the way in which universities are structured and curricula are structured. And from the 1994 group's point of view, yes, I've talked about the role that we think that we need to look more broadly at the way the sector is oriented. But equally, in our submission to Lord Brown, we make it very clear that we want to see, I think the words are, a breakdown in the artificial boundaries between full-time and part-time education. We want to see flexibility within programmes where, if those barriers are brought down around student support, that students can come onto our degree programmes and study notionally full-time, can move to studying notionally part-time, can go back to studying full-time, and as long as they graduate within a certain number of years, which would have to be considered to be acceptable, but the student would know that when they started, that there should be much, much fewer constraints on the way in which a degree is actually perceived in terms of the time and nature of that qualification.
I think when we have this debate, the role that FE plays in terms of providing HE is always, it seems to me, forgotten. And that from an economic point of view, if we're going to deliver the high level skills that the economy is going to need, it's going to have to be done largely through part-time work-based learning. And that means it's largely going to have to be done through FE. Because there's no way, that given the cuts in student numbers, there's no way that we're going to meet that requirement in any other way.
Yes, please.
Hi there. My name is David Walker. I'm Director of Programme and Public Policy at a business-led education charity called Career Academies UK, which works with about 120 schools, colleges and sixth forms around the country to raise the aspirations of middle-achieving young people at level three, many of whom are doing BTEC diplomas as well as A-levels. My question is, obviously we've got some interesting mood music already from the new government in terms of the sense that they're cutting diploma funding, BTECs look as though they're going to be around for a bit longer. It looks as though, you know, in a sense, it's carrying on as it is, but there's a level of uncertainty. My major question is that certainly in terms of university places, we've noticed already from last year, comparing to figures from previous years, that the number of young people going from our programme into higher education or a high-level job, the actual number going to university has dropped from somewhere in the high 70s to the low 70s over the last year or so, which is obviously an issue around credentialing around places. I suppose one of my big questions really is, in terms of the whole issue now between widening participation and fair access, what that actually is going to mean in real terms. If we're looking at getting, in many cases, the children we work with are from non-traditional backgrounds, what that's going to mean in real terms, particularly for those who are going into, you know, the non-Russell Group universities, the new universities, if we can still call them that, and really, I guess whether or not, I suppose this has put the cat amongst the pigeons a little bit, whether or not we ought to be with some of our students now more saying, well, actually, aren't you better off considering whether or not you ought to be going, looking at work-based learning, going into work, looking at going through, maybe getting your degree part-time, looking at that way, rather than necessarily looking for the goal of HE is a match of default, because, you know, clearly what we're potentially facing the risk of is a number of students where we've raised their aspirations, but there's a potential that we may be disappointing those if we continue along the current road. I just want to sort of throw that out to the panel for their views.
Mm-hmm. I think that fair access is cheaper than widening participation. I don't think it's as fundamental as widening participation. I mean, in a sense, with fair access, you can identify, you know, you can handpick a few bright sort of working class kids and determine that you're going to get them into selective university and turn them into bright middle class kids, which is what the grammar school system used to do, it seemed to me. But in terms of widening participation, you're talking about fundamentally changing notions of social mobility, and you're talking about challenging sort of stereotypes which have existed for many, many years. And to do that, I mean, I think I tried to make the point, I think, that to actually carry out widening participation, you have to have some form of government spending and you have to have some form of government intervention. You cannot leave it to some kind of notional private sector, even if it's Goldie Hawn with her breathing schools, I think it was the idea. Whereas fair access is different. You can, and I think that that is one of the fundamental reasons why there's being a shift. And I, as I said earlier, that shift was beginning to happen in the last year of the Labour government. It's not a political change. It was a realisation that why non-participation is hugely expensive, and actually with diplomas, a realisation that actually if you want to really give a good diploma experience, that's very expensive as well. And all the good intentions were there, but the reality is now beginning to come home to play.
Yes.
An interesting comment, as you touched upon the idea of universities as default. There's the issue of further education maybe becoming a substitute for what previously might have been a university education. There's the issue of work-based solutions. But there's another big solution there which is already happening, certainly here in London, and that is the growth of private providers. And if Lord Brown should put the cap up from, say, 3,300 to 5,000 or more, many private providers will say they can give a good quality of generic education for less than that, which totally misses out on the government contribution, but if it is going to decrease anyway, and we're involved in cost shifting to the student/client, I think we have to be well prepared to realise it will not just be at the upper end of the prestigious overseas universities that now offer programmes here. It will in fact be for those who can't get or don't want to afford to pay that high level of contribution for a university place and therefore choose to go with a private provider that still might give a degree, still might actually give a British degree, still might give it near your home. I think that's going to become a very confused and more mixed economy than we've seen. We've got it in the other areas of higher education already, the postgraduate coursework and various aspects of research, but I think we're now seeing this fundamental shift in the balance of public and private interest and contribution in the undergraduate space. That worries me because I would like to think that every citizen does have some sense of entitlement to public education of quality.
I would just add that it's... The situation you described, I mean, thank you so much for asking the question, because actually that's exactly the kind of information that we need to go into the kind of discussions that we're having. I mean, while I have sat across the table, certainly in the last few weeks, with former ministers who were kind of looking back at us and almost accusing us of continuing to fail because somehow applications to universities were going up and up and up and there was nothing they could do about it. This is the result of 13 years of huge investment in higher education, a huge amount of effort from a huge number of people to raise aspirations, and we are in the position now where we are completely stuck and we know no way of actually getting out of the situation beyond actually redefining the question, which is exactly the point that you're asking. Actually saying, so is this the right time for us to suddenly be stepping back and saying, actually, we know we've raised these aspirations with you because we know that we believe that the best way of targeting university entrance is to start working with you when you're in primary school or early in junior years. But now you've actually got to the point that you could go to university. Actually, we need to tell you need to do something else. It is not a very fair situation for us to be in. So we've got to find our way out of it. And I suppose I think there has to be a whole number of solutions, and the government has got to be willing to actually tackle them. But actually, I know that Lord Brown is very concerned in terms of the work that he is doing to find ways in which the student number cap can be relaxed and ultimately removed if it can be afforded. Now, the problem is that in order to do that, we have to move into a world which actually, as Malcolm said, does involve other providers, does involve putting fee caps up, doing all kinds of things which actually lots of people will find not particularly nice either. But the problem is that we have a system which is incredibly... The government has found itself in a situation where it now has an incredibly successful system, but an incredibly expensive system that it cannot afford and the country cannot afford. So how can we actually move forward, actually allow all students to realise their aspirations, but actually have a system which the country itself can actually afford to run? And it's a really difficult question. Mm.
We've got a sort of 3 or 4 minutes left if anybody else would like to come in at this point. Yes, lady in the middle, and then perhaps we could take more than one at a time. There's a gentleman just in front.
Hi, I'm Julie Evans. I'm from London Metropolitan University. I'm a faculty recruitment coordinator, which means I look at thousands and thousands of application forms for psychology and science at my university. I would like to bring the point back to careers counselling and guidance at a much earlier stage, because I also come across a lot of applications where the attainment of the student is potentially very good and they've done really well, but unfortunately they're not qualified in terms of subject discipline for the course that they're applying for. This is particularly true in the sciences. And I think that with less places available, that it is even more important at a much earlier stage to work with pupils in schools or further education to sort of say, well, if you are thinking of doing this course at university, these are the choices that you should make. And I think there is still a great lack of advice and information, whoever is responsible for that. Obviously, it's not one body's responsibility. And I think that becomes even more and more important. And I think that no matter how transparent the information is about courses and entry requirements, there will always be people who think, oh, well, I'm just going to ignore that and I'm just going to apply for this course. And then, of course, they end up with no place at university because they haven't chosen the right course in terms of their aspirations and their qualifications. So I'd just like to bring perhaps some discussion back to that.
Thank you. My question is a little more technical, I think. I'm working with Malcolm, as it happens, on the Shell projects at London Higher. All our speakers have talked about the increasing atomization, personalization of the experience, a shift from widening participation to fair access. And I do wonder, in that move from, if you like, cohorts to individuals, what that means for the kinds of data that are captured if we have got a coalition government that endures for 5 years and will be wanting over that length of time, as the previous government did, to see positive examples of these policy shifts biting.
Right. Phil, do you want to take on the IAG
one
to start with? Well, both?
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right. It's a difficult thing to answer. I mean, obviously, there is a requirement on schools now to provide earlier IAG from year seven onwards, which is going to be checked by Ofsted, if Ofsted still exists, which is a positive thing. I think there has to be some significant changes with the way that Connections works. I mean, Connections have been so overrun with dealing with the NEET problem that there has been very, very little emphasis given to actual specific advice on higher education. And I did some work actually with SSAT recently, talking about what kind of provision there was for teachers in terms of understanding how HE functioned now. And I was surprised, because I expected a lot of AIM Higher partnerships to actually provide information, advice and guidance. But what they actually weren't providing was the kind of information, advice and guidance, or as much as I thought they would be providing, to teachers in schools. And I think there is a huge gap there that has to be filled, because I think that even if you put it on the school curriculum from year seven, unless you have people who actually understand the way that HE works nowadays, then you've got real problems. And I have to say, those people are in a serious minority. As far as the second one is concerned, I mean, you're right. It's been notoriously difficult already to provide national data to governments or to BIS and to be able to say, this is the result of AIM Higher activity. This is where your money's gone. You can actually justify what you've done. It's been incredibly difficult. And I think HEFCE and certainly Action Access, we've accepted that now you can only do it on a local level, that we can provide local indications of how spending has actually improved attainment. But if we do go down this road towards personalised curriculum, which I still think you have to go down, I think it's absolutely fundamental, then it is going to be increasingly difficult. It's interesting that the requirement for AIM Higher partnerships to look at NSEC data for their cohort has now been removed, because HEFCE recognise how difficult it is to collect data specifically on people's social background and occupational data. So I think, you're caught in a hard place there, aren't you? You want to provide that evidence, but it's very, very difficult unless you want to provide evidence which is not reliable.
I would add to that picking up on Malcolm's notion of a coalition, that one of the things that we have considered there to be a gap is actually that quite often universities are asked to demonstrate how successful their engagement processes have been. And if you're working in a consortium or through an AIM-HIRE partnership, then it's possible maybe to actually have a judge a wider success of your activities. But actually, quite often some schools are engaged in quite different ways with different universities doing quite different things. So where is it seems to us that actually it might be useful if you create a connection so the school itself is in some way responsible for actually determining how successful some of the partnerships it has with higher education providers, further education colleges, etc. have been. And not that we wish to create additional accountancy burdens, but actually that governing bodies within schools themselves may have some role in terms of judging how successful their contacts have actually been. And that was a recommendation that we have put to Lord Brown specifically.
Oh, just one word on a corner of John's question. I see us at the moment having a bit of a dilemma as to whether we're going to try to have even better national measurement of, let's use the word, standards at various stages in our educational cycle, or whether we're in fact going to decentralise and deregulate and recognise the market itself will vote with its feet and its money to go where it wants. I think there are dangers in going to both extremes, but what neither of them still isn't able to do is to work out what the actual value add of education is. It always concerns me when I see league tables that say, well, these wonderful students came in and you get a rating, good rating for that, and then these wonderful students went out and you get a good rating for that. And the value add might have, in fact, as one American study shows, been negative. Actually, American university students are worse at maths after 4 years than before they started. I don't know how good they were even when they started. And so we've got a problem there. How do we actually look at the value add, which is what education is all about, rather than simply the codification of achievement at various stages and giving it various ratings? Luckily, with the disintegration of league tables, or any one of them, sorry, John, as being really reliable measures of anything, because now they're so common you can customise them and play with them just as you want, I think we're getting back into still the dilemma of how we look at the value add in all of our educational processes.
John, just quickly on that one. It's interesting that one of the questions that Lord Brown himself actually asked in the last submission was actually how to measure quality. Now, it's a different issue in a sense because he's more concerned about kind of universities delivering high quality. And the discussions that have taken place around that issue have actually led to a conclusion that anyone can come up with a definition about how you can actually judge quality, probably on the back of an envelope in 3 seconds. But equally, everybody else can then dismiss it as a completely irrational way of doing that. So actually, there is a danger on all of these things that we get faced with the pressure that, yes, we need to have some data which can demonstrate success. But on the other hand, well, I suppose the best thing would be let us decide what that data should be and tell government that this is the best way of measuring success, because actually at least we can come up with it on the back of the envelope rather than them.
Although universities have never chosen to do that in the past. I'm afraid we've sort of run over time. There will be another discussion session this afternoon. Thank you to all three of our speakers this morning.